going to be talking about the science of CRISPR because I'm not quite sure how much science you know with regards to CRISPR, what exactly CRISPR is, and how we would use it to edit genomes, including human genomes. I'm then going to move on to discuss three distinctions. And distinctions are contrasts that help us to think through the entire intellectual, conceptual scheme that we're going to use when we get to the ethics. And the ethics here is, I am a molecular biologist, but I am a Catholic priest and I'm a moral theologian. But I'm so used now to talking to secular audiences so that in this ethics talk, I'd like to also compare and contrast a secular approach to bioethics as well as a Christian or a Catholic one. So you get a sense of the similarities and difference and why these two ethical approaches can often reach diametrically opposed conclusions and claims about what should or should not be done with a particular technology. So I'm going to begin with the science of CRISPR. And I have to start with just simply by defining the genome, because I'm not quite sure how many of you are familiar with genomic science. So the genome consists of all the genetic information of an organism. And so here's a human being, here's a human cell, and this is the nucleus of the cell. This is kind of like the control center of the cell. And you have the nuclear genome composed of, in our species, of 46 chromosomes, 23 from dad and 23 from mom. You also have a small genome, actually, from the mitochondrial genome. The mitochondria is the energy-producing organelle of the cell. It's the part of the cell that produces the energy that the cell will need in order for it to function. Now, if you take one of these chromosomes and you extend it, so this is one of the 46, for example, chromosomes that we have, one of the things that's incredibly striking, of course, is that at the end of the day, this is the very famous double helix. But the double helix is organized and compacted so that it fits very much into the nucleus of the cell. Just to give you a sense of the sizes that we're dealing with here, the largest human cell, the human oocyte, the human egg, is about the size of a period at the end of a New Times Roman sentence, 12-point font, and sometimes I get confused. And so what you do then is if you take this DNA double helix and you depict it in an easy way, what you do is that you see that DNA is made up of four different components, and they're indicated in this image by GATC, and each one of this is a nucleotide. But hopefully what you can see is that at the end of the day, it looks like text. So, and you and I, our genome is made up of 3 billion of these bases or so. We have approximately 20,000, 21,000 genes. And this is actually a gene. And one of the things, if you're a molecular biologist, is that you can look at the sequence of letters and you can actually define the gene. So just like an English sentence has a capital letter to indicate where it starts and a period to indicate where it ends, you have an ATG that begins a gene in DNA. And in this particular case, you have the stop codon, the period is TAA. And there are 3 variants of this sequence that indicates the stop. And this turns out, actually, this is the sequence of the gene that my students and I have been working on now for 7 years. It's a Bax inhibitor. It's a gene that's involved, that's been linked to several cancers. And we use yeast as a model organism for that. Now, so CRISPR is a molecular editing machine, and it allows us to edit that sequence of three billion letters. And so there are several components of the machine. It's called CRISPR-Cas because you have a protein component. This is actually the machine component. It's called Cas9 in one particular species of bacteria. And then you have a RNA molecule. And the RNA molecule is a guide RNA. And I'm not going to go into the molecular biology of it. I just want to let you know that it's made up of 2 components. And what you have is you have a targeting component. So the guide RNA targets the machine. And when the machine lands on the correct site, it actually makes a cut. And what you get is you have a double cut. So here's the targeted DNA. You get a double cut, and then this double cut can be resolved, it can be healed in several ways. And one way is to actually just attempt to repair it, and I'm not going to go into the different biological mechanisms that the cell uses to repair it, but inevitably what happens is it attempts to repair it, and then it makes a mess out of it, and it knocks the gene out. So here you actually can destroy the gene. Now, if at the same time you introduce a repair template, then what this cell is able to do is it's able to repair this gap in such a way that you can intentionally introduce a new sequence into the genome of that cell or the genome of that organism. So what this allows us to do is we can basically take an eraser. If you have an encyclopedia of 3 billion letters, you can go in there and erase a single letter and replace that letter with, say, a G, you can replace it with an A or a T. And this allows us to really, in a way that we could not do before, edit the genome with incredible precision. Now, a lot of my students will say, where did CRISPR come from? So CRISPR actually evolved as a bacterial cell's way of defending itself against virus. So this is a bacterial cell. It's a schematic of the bacterial cell. Here is a virus, a bacteriophage. It injects its own DNA into the bacterial cell in an attempt to take over that cell. And the CRISPR machinery takes fragments of that viral DNA and incorporates it into the bacteria's own genome as a molecular memory of that infection. So in a secondary infection, so the second time that bacteriophage, you know, let's say, for example, this bacteria survives that first attack. During the second attack, what will happen is that the CRISPR system will be used to destroy the incoming DNA that the bacteria receives from the second assault from the virus. And the goal here is to basically prevent the virus from taking hold of the cell. So we're just talking a matter of 5 or 6 years. We have a revolution in science because we've taken this bacterial immune system, we've taken the machinery that the bacteria uses to defend itself, and we've taken it and we've now developed it here at MIT and at Berkeley to use it as a gene editing machine. And these are just some of the advances. So even a couple of years after the publication of the first use of CRISPR, you have the... So Feng Zhang is an MIT professor, and so what happens is you're now able to engineer fish, you're able to engineer monkeys, and as you'll see in a minute, we've been able to do it for the first time. This was last year in Oregon with human beings. So this is just to highlight some of the research that has been done. So this is a mouse model of tyrosinemia. This is the inability to metabolize tyrosine. So tyrosine is an amino acid. It's one of the 20 amino acids that you and I use on a regular basis. And there are individuals who are born with a mutation in a gene. The gene is called FAH, and they're not able to break down tyrosine. And there's a mouse model for this inherited disease in humans. And what the team, again, a team from MIT in collaboration with UMass in Worcester, what they were able to do is they were able to use CRISPR to introduce corrective changes to the liver, the diseased liver of mice, so that a certain percentage of the liver of the mouse, the cells of the mouse, were now normal. They were now wild type. And just a fraction of the cells in the liver having restored function was able to cure the mouse from the disease and alleviate all the symptomology associated with the disease. So this is the liver of mice. We are also now able to do what are called gene drives, and we can edit the genomes now not of individuals, but entire animal populations. So this is an attempt, so there's a lot of discussion about using this to eliminate mosquitoes. So with the Zika threat, a lot of people are saying, let's just use a gene drive to eliminate mosquitoes. Now, to give you a sense of what happened, so this is the normal inheritance. You have one wild type. Wild type means normal. This is the normal copy. Then you have an altered copy. And because children inherit only one copy of each parent's genomes, what you have is you have 50% chance of passing it on. But using CRISPR, and I'm not going to go into the details, what you can do is you can set up a system so that every single child, every single progeny of an adult will actually inherit the diseased or the gene that you wanted to inherit. And if this gene actually kills the adult, what you can end up doing is you can eradicate an entire population of mosquitoes. The danger, of course, is we're not quite sure how eradicating an entire species will alter the ecosystem, and that's part of the ethics of this, right? So yes, you might be able to get rid of Zika, but there would be a whole bunch of other things that you might get rid of too, and we're not quite sure if we're willing to take that risk. And you can see that this is a ongoing public policy discussion in our country today, not just in our country, but also in Africa, where mosquitoes are important vectors for malaria. And so the idea is, can we, in fact, for the first time in human history, eradicate malaria by targeting the vector, the mosquito vector that's carrying malaria? And there are millions of people who suffer from malaria. And so there are questions now about what sort of risks on an environmental scale would we be willing to take to alleviate the suffering of millions of human beings. Now, in humans, CRISPR can be used to edit our genomes, and there are two ways to do this. One is in vivo editing, and the other one is called ex vivo, and we're going to talk about that a little bit when we get to the distinctions, but I'm going to begin the discussion here. So in vivo editing is that you want to edit the DNA of cells or tissues within the body of the patient. And there are different ways where you can attempt to introduce the editing machinery, the CRISPR machinery, into the target cell. So this is called in vivo editing. A lot of people, for example, are talking about viruses and using viruses as vectors in order to introduce the gene editing machinery into cells. But the more popular version of this at the moment is called ex vivo editing. I was at the AAAS meeting last week in Austin, Texas, speaking about CRISPR, and I had a colleague on the panel who was talking about how his laboratory at Duke was using ex vivo CRISPR editing in order to correct, as you'll see in the next slide, sickle cell anemia, then sickle cell disease. So the idea here is that you take stem cells from the patient's body, and you use CRISPR to edit the genomes of the cells outside the body. Once those cells outside the body have been corrected, you then reintroduce those corrected cells back into the patient. And so you see there's a big difference here, because here you've got to figure out how to get the machinery specifically to the cells you want. Here in ex vivo editing, you have the cells outside, so basically you can make sure that the cells you reintroduce back into the patients are in fact the cells that have been edited. And so this is one example of ex vivo editing. This is a GTG. This is a DNA sequence for sickle cell. It gives rise to the sickle cell shape. And by just changing the DNA sequence from GTG to GAG, you can restore normal, healthy red blood cells. The idea is that this would be done outside the body. It would then, these corrected cells would then be reintroduced into the body to engraft in the bone marrow to then rehabilitate the entire hematopoietic system, the blood system of the patient. Now, in vivo editing, some of the most recent research actually involves blindness, because it's easy to access the eye. And so here, this is gene therapy to prevent blindness. You have degeneration of the retina, and so what you do is you basically are able to introduce DNA that will allow you to edit a mutation in the retina in order to prevent those cells from undergoing programmed cell death, from undergoing cell suicide. Now, I was mentioning to you that we have now been able to do using CRISPR, we've been able to use CRISPR to edit human embryos. And this was the work of Shukran Mitalipov at Oregon, in Portland. And what he does here is, using human eggs with a mutant sperm, he's able to use CRISPR-Cas9 in order to alter the sequence, the pattern of the sperm's DNA. Now, I am aware that there is a manuscript on BioArchive that has not yet undergone peer review that has raised questions about this paper, about the mechanism of action of this paper. I have not had it, because it hasn't gone through peer review yet, it's not quite clear what to make of the dispute. But the idea here is that it's very hard for us to imagine, as biologists, how these two pieces of DNA, how the normal piece has been used to correct the mutant piece when we know biologically that they are separated in space within the developing embryo. So there's a lot of biological questions as to how this could have happened. So now we're talking about distinctions. I mentioned the ex vivo versus in vivo distinction, and that's, again, this distinction where the in vivo gene therapy is used to edit cells within the patient's body, while ex vivo is used to edit cells outside the patient's body, and then once the editing has been confirmed, the cells are then reintroduced back into the body, hopefully to cure a particular disease. I'm now going to have to introduce another distinction that's very important, and you have to keep in mind when we talk about the ethics. This is the distinction between somatic and germline. And the distinction is the following. Somatic cells are cells of the body other than the reproductive cells, sperm and egg, that would be used to form individuals of the next generation. And so you can imagine different approaches using CRISPR to edit cells of patients. For example, you can edit lungs, muscles, liver. The idea is that you can target this patient's tissues, this patient's cells, but you also know that your targeting, your use of the CRISPR-Cas system is not going to alter his sperm, for example, or her egg. So you know that the children are not going to be affected. But in contrast, you have germline gene therapy, and here the idea is you're intentionally altering the DNA that will be used for the next generation. And there's a lot of debate in our culture, in our civilization, about whether or not we should alter the DNA of future generations of individuals who are not yet available, alive, to give consent. And we live in a culture where the ethics is primarily addressed by consent questions. I'm going to address that when we get to ethics. And so you can see if the patient's children are not able to give consent, can you in fact justify altering his or her genome? I'm going to spend a little time on this distinction. It's called therapy versus enhancement. And a lot of people will use this distinction in order to make ethical arguments. And I've argued, actually I wrote a paper, it's been published, that this distinction is not as clear as some would have it. Now I'm writing as a Catholic bioethicist, so I'm addressing a particular issue within the Catholic moral tradition. So for example, this is Dignitas Personae, this is the Vatican's most recent document on bioethics, and there are paragraphs in this document that deal with gene therapy and genetic engineering. And a distinction is made in paragraph 26, where the claim is made that therapeutic purposes are in principle morally licit, and therapeutic purposes are defined as such actions that seek to restore the normal genetic configuration of the patient, or to counter damage caused by genetic anomalies or those related to other pathologies. So this is the therapy side of the therapy enhancement distinction. In that very same paragraph, there is a strong pushback against enhancement, and enhancement is assumed to be improving and strengthening the gene pool. And the assumption here is that you have a norm for what constitutes the average value of a particular trait, and you can increase or decrease that value, and that would then be enhancing the gene pool. Now, there's an interesting poll that was done recently. If you ask parents, what do they want to do with their kids in terms of changing their kids, giving them and altering their properties, intelligence, health, creativity, attractiveness, and weight, these are for people who think that alteration is ethical. And then if you ask individuals who are opposed to alteration, they will still talk about health, intelligence, weight, creativity, and kindness. So these are some of the important traits that our society deems to be worthy of being genetically manipulated. Now, I'm going to raise the question, is the distinction between therapy and enhancement a robust one? And I'm going to suggest to you that it's not, and that we already, even today, we already have therapies in place. They're not genetic therapies, but there are therapies in place that stretch this distinction. And I'm going to ask this question. What should target LDL levels be for patients at risk for cardiovascular disease? So LDL is like the bad cholesterol. And what's really striking is if you ask this question, doctors are not really sure. So if you look at the average LDL among U.S. adults aged 20 to 74 years of age, it's 119 milligrams per deciliter, and the normal range is thought to be 90 to 130. Now, you have these recommended target LDLs. Now, it's striking how you see how optimal is basically less than 100, even though if you look at the range is 90 to 130. Now, that's because if you look at hunter-gatherer tribes, their average LDL is 17 milligrams per deciliter. And if you look at non-human primates, it's even lower, 30 to 50 milligrams per deciliter. And there is one individual with a mutation in the PCSK9 gene, 15 milligrams per deciliter, and he is healthy as anything can be. Okay. So the normal range is 9 to 130, but you have this individual, 15 milligrams, and he's healthy as anything. And this is really interesting, because when you ask this question, if therapy returns the patient to the species norm, then we should target the 70 to 130. Because again, therapy by definition is to return to the norm. The difficulty is not quite clear what the norm is. And then there are many studies that have shown that the lower the LDL levels, the healthier you are. And so, in fact, if I talk to cardiologists, they'll just go, as low as you can. Just keep going down. And use statins. Just keep going down. The idea is that the lower, the better. So that's what the consensus seems to be, right? We should lower LDL levels even beyond the species norm to preserve and protect human health. And when I talk to Catholic bioethicists, they have no problems with this. And I go, isn't this enhancement? You see, because are we not using pharmacological means? We're not dealing with genetic means. We're dealing with pharmacological means to basically take individuals and we're pushing their physiology outside the human normal range in order to protect and preserve their health. And a lot of people say, yeah, that's okay, actually. That's okay. And you see, this is why I don't think therapy enhancement, there is, you can't really make that distinction, because there are therapeutic enhancements that do promote the human good of health, and this is one of them. And we do this routinely by millions of people are taking statins in order to lower their LDL levels, and the goal is to lower their LDL levels as much as they can. So I'm proposing, actually, instead of talking about enhancement versus therapy, we need to talk about therapeutic versus non-therapeutic. And that's a better way of talking about this distinction, because there are going to be enhancements that are actually therapeutic. But if this is the case, then we have to consider the following reality. So if statin use to lower LDL levels is morally good, and there seems to be consensus amongst most people and most moral theologians that I've talked to, then how about genetic changes? And I'm talking here about what I call genetic immunizations. So here, this is a CCR5 delta 32 mutation. If you're a biologist, you know that this is a mutation that protects you from HIV infection, from AIDS, actually. So you can be HIV positive but never get AIDS. And CCR5 is a molecule that the AIDS virus used to enter human cells. And this mutation of 32, just 32, the Delta 32 mutation, actually prevents the HIV virus from entering human cells. And so the patient is HIV positive, but is completely healthy for the rest of his life. Now, his sexual partners, that's not the case, right? But what you have here is that you have a CCR5 mutation, and I was just reading online, it's really striking. It's not an old mutation, it's been linked. It appeared about 1,000 to 2,000 years ago between that, and it's Northern Europeans, Irish. Lots, a significant proportion of individuals of Irish heritage carry this mutation that makes them immune to HIV, makes them immune to AIDS. Now, we do not know. There doesn't seem to be any health defects associated with this particular mutation. So the question that is, there are a lot of people who are asking this question, if we are able to alter the white blood cells of a patient so that he or she is now resistant to HIV, should we do that? Here's another thing, P53 is a tumor suppressor gene. It's a guardian of the genome. Now you and I have two copies, one from mom, one from dad. We get cancer. Turns out elephants, they don't get cancer. The reason why is they have 20 copies, 20 from mom and 20 from dad. And so they have 40 copies. And one of the things you have to know is most cancers require that the cancer disable the P53 gene. So if you've got 40 copies in your cells, it's really hard to disable all 40 copies in the single cell, which is why elephants are somewhat resistant to cancer. And the idea here is they're so big that the number of cell divisions to generate that mass is so much, that's orders of magnitude more than ours, that they have evolved basically extra copies of this gene to protect themselves against cancer, which is related to DNA replication. So the question is, why not give extra copies of P53 to people? An extra copy to every human being, get rid of cancer. You see? And so here you genetically immunize future generations against cancer. You would eradicate cancer, in theory. The question, of course, is yes, animals are fine, elephants are fine with 20 copies of P53. The question is, no one's ever looked to see if 20 copies of P53 in a human being would give rise to problems. P53 is involved in numerous processes. Even just yesterday in my cancer biology class, we were talking about how P53 is essential for the tanning process. So when you go out there, you know, yesterday it was 70 degrees, you thought about summer, and then today it's absolutely cold and miserable, it's snowing out. But it was a promise from God, summer's coming. And so when you go out there for the summer and you roast yourself under the sun, what you're actually doing in order to get that tan is you're inducing P53 gene expression. So again, I there's always going to have to be caution, but I'm just raising the possibility that your children will be able to avail themselves of this kind of genetic technology. All right, finally, in the third section, we're going to talk about the ethics. And I'm going to take this opportunity to discuss the differences and similarities between several ethical traditions. We live in a pluralistic society. And so I'm going to compare and contrast the secular tradition of bioethics with a Christian Catholic one. I am a molecular biologist, but I do a significant amount of work in bioethics. And so what's really striking is I've had to learn to go out and speak to my colleagues who come from a secular background. And I want you to see the similarities and differences between these two. And this, and we're going to talk, you know, the DNA CRISPR-Cas is hot. This is just the cover of some, in the last year or two, a cover of some of the magazines and journals dealing with gene editing. And I'm going to ask this question, what does a faith-based approach look like in comparison to a secular approach? And I'm going to suggest to you that the biggest difference between a secular approach and a Christian or Catholic approach has to deal with dignity. And so we're going to look at dignity. And remember that document from the Vatican? So the very first sentence, the very first line of that document is the following. The dignity of a person must be recognized in every human being from conception to natural death. This fundamental principle expresses a great yes to human life and must be at the center of ethical reflection on biomedical research. So for a Catholic bioethicist looking at this question, it's about dignity. So we have to talk about dignity. Now, dignity is not just a Catholic or a Christian concept, because if you look at the first sentence of the Grundgesetz, the Grundgesetz is the constitution of the Federal Republic of Germany. This is the very first line. Human dignity shall be inviolable. To respect and protect it shall be the duty of all state authority. It's a very striking sentence, the very first sentence of the Constitution of the Federal Republic. Now, I go to Germany 4 times a year to talk about human dignity because there's a lot of debate as to what human dignity is. The biggest divide in contemporary ethics is about this. What exactly do we mean by dignity? And so we're going to talk about what is it. And in order for me to explain this to you, I have to ask you this question. How much are you worth? Dignity is an attempt to answer that question. Now, if I ask you this, how much is an iPhone 7? I'm going to have to specify 32G because there's different variations, right? If I ask how much is an iPhone 7 worth, there are actually two values that you can give me. So there's an intrinsic and an extrinsic value. So you look at the teardown cost, and there are people who do this. They take the phone, I'm sure they do it here at MIT, and they rip them apart, and they cost the phone. And the cost is $219.80. It's plus or minus a couple of dollars, depending upon who you look at and who you Google. Now, the suggested retail price is $649. Wow, the markup is huge. But what I want to impress upon you is that there are two values associated with the worth of this phone. The intrinsic value and the extrinsic one. Now, faith-based traditions make this claim that you and I also have intrinsic and extrinsic value. Intrinsic and extrinsic worth. And when I go out and have conversations with my secular colleagues, it is this point where we always end up having where we realize this is why we disagree. So, intrinsic dignity is the inherent worth of the human person. When I ask my students, how much are you worth? How much will your mother say you are worth? I am priceless. This is a fundamental claim that you and I are priceless. Now, Kant actually says this, so this is not necessarily Christian. He says that you and I have no price. We have dignity. It's an interesting contrast. That what makes us persons is we do not have price. Now, of course, we also have extrinsic dignity. This is the social worth of the human person. Now, in our culture, that's usually tied to your salary. It's also tied to your net worth. If your salary is huge enough, then you have a net worth. It also comes with celebrity or high office. Right? We stand when the President of the United States comes in. Why? Because he has dignity. He has a worth that we acknowledge when we stand. And so here's the question, right? What is the basis of this faith-based claim that we have this? Everyone agrees we have this. You see? It is this that is disputed today. Because now, these are some of the characteristics of intrinsic dignity. It is the worth of the human person simply because he or she is human. Just like how much is this iPhone worth? It's worth $217. No matter where you buy it, no matter who has it, this is how much it's worth. The intrinsic value. This is the worth of what it is. Inherent in this account is that it is not earned or bestowed. This is just what it is. It is acknowledged and recognized. Now, one of the reasons why human dignity is cited at the beginning of the Grundgesetz, the German federal constitution of the Republic of Germany, is because that constitution was written in response to the atrocities of the Nazi era. And so at the very beginning, they wanted to say, human dignity is beyond government recognition or acknowledgement or degradation. The government should not be able to lower your dignity, because obviously the Nazi state was able to do that. And so the idea here is you can only acknowledge or recognize it. It is not earned, it is not bestowed. But because of that, you see, it's absolute. It cannot increase or decrease. This is how much it's worth. And it cannot be lost as long as one is a human being. There is no such thing as partial intrinsic dignity. Because it is based on, as soon as you become human, you have this worth. When you stop being human, you lose that worth. And no government, no state, no other human being, not even yourself, can remove or add to that dignity. See, this is the account of intrinsic dignity that is at the heart of a Christian Catholic bioethics. And not surprisingly, it's heavily contested today. So for Christians, there's a theological grounding for this. There's also philosophical grounding, but I'm going to focus. It is because we are made in the image and likeness of God. Imago Dei. So once you establish there's a God, you have a hierarchy of worth, a hierarchy of value, the closer you up to the top, the more valuable you are. And since we are made in the image and likeness of God, who is invaluable and priceless in himself, we are also invaluable and priceless in ourselves. This is a fundamental Christian claim. Now, so from a Christian perspective, what bioethicists do is we have to judge human actions, including CRISPR, and we have to see whether or not these human actions will protect, preserve, and advance both intrinsic and extrinsic dignity. And this is what the difference is. We'll go to the questions at the end. Now, the idea here is that, and this is the heart of Catholic bioethics, human actions that fail to acknowledge the inestimable worth of the human person are immoral. Now, if you look, this is a huge disagreement today. So, for example, Ruth Macklin, very provocative paper in the British Medical Journal, dignity is a useless concept. It means no more than respect for persons or their autonomy. And you will see that in contrast, where dignity is at the heart of a Christian, a Catholic bioethics, on a secular side, it's about consent. It's about autonomy. It's about the freedom to choose. And your choice is sacrosanct, and your choice is the center of morality. If you choose it, it's good. And so when I sit on bioethics committees, ethics committees, it's really striking, when I sit on the ethics committee of a secular hospital, the most important person on that panel is the lawyer. Because the lawyer gets to decide who makes the choice. You see, because the question is about who makes the choice. Because once the person is identified, it is your choice to make, then your choice has to be radically respected and acknowledged as such. If you sit on a Catholic ethics committee, like I've sat on there, the question is dignity, not autonomy per se. Steve Pinker, up the river, the stupidity of dignity. Again, it's a frontal attack on dignity because there are thinkers who acknowledge that this is what we fundamentally disagree upon. And for these individuals, human dignity, if it is used in language, simply means no more than respect for personal autonomy. And so when I say I respect your dignity, or you have dignity, it means that I have to respect your autonomy. That's the way a secular account will acknowledge dignity, while a Christian account will not focus on that. It actually focuses on the kind of being you are and the kind of worth that you have. Now, one of the things I do when I go talk to my secular colleagues is I go, why is autonomy worthy of respect? So why is autonomy valuable? Now, I'm going to look at this as a biologist, and I say this, you see, intellect and will. So intellect, the capacity to know, will, the capacity to choose. From a biologic perspective, they are not intrinsically more valuable than other adaptations. And think of it this way. If tomorrow you ended up waking up in the middle of the Arctic tundra and you got to choose between having autonomy and having basically polar bear characteristics, which one would be more valuable to you? Which one would you choose? And my students say they'd rather be a polar bear in the tundra than a naked human being by himself, dead, and basically the food of the polar bears. One of the things that's really striking is that we are adapted for particular ecological niches. So we are best in an urban area. When human beings are working together, right, We are able to, we have culture, we have history, we have technology. Now, a polar bear in the middle of Boston is dead. Whether or not he's got jaws, he'll be dead in a moment because we'll shoot him and kill him. So adaptations, in terms of value from a biological perspective, depends upon the environment which you have. There is no objective way of saying that being human is much, much more valuable than being a polar bear. It depends. And this is something, I grew up in Thailand, and this is something that I discovered because it's a non-Christian culture. And one of the things my friends would say is, you know, if you have an account of reincarnation where this particular mosquito could be your great-great-great-grandmother, then there's no reason to believe that you are more valuable than that mosquito. Because that is your great-great-great-grandmother, and you love her dearly. And you see, it's interesting how in a non-Christian context, this claim that we are cooler than the other animals becomes more and more tenuous. And it's really striking when you grow up in a non-Christian culture to discover that, right? Things that are simply taken for granted, that for example, we have inalienable rights because we are created by the Creator. In non-Christian cultures, that is not clear to my friends. In fact, the notion that men and women are actually intrinsically equal in Bangkok, where I grew up, was very strange. Because a lot of people would say, isn't it clear that men are superior? A girl I was dating a long time ago basically ended up saying, you know, she was like, when we get married, I'm going to help you pick your minor wife. And I was like, why is that? And she goes, because you're a guy and you need women. And I'd rather have one woman in the basement rather than you going up cavorting in the brothels. And this was just the assumption. This is the cultural assumption that she had. And she's very well educated. She has a doctorate in pharmacology. But her culture and her way of looking at the world, it was not immediately self. And I would say, no, that's not going to happen because I'm going to love you and we're just equal. We're not equal. And it's really striking when you're talking to someone who just does not take, in many ways, the Christian account of the human person for granted, and you discover that it's not as universally self-evident as you may think it to be. Now, in contrast to autonomy, an account of dignity has explanatory power. So I'll give you an example. Human dignity is the ground for the claim that we are all equal regardless of any genetic, cognitive, or social difference. And when you, this again, from a biologist's perspective, there is no one trait that you can identify that is equal in all of us. If you talk about smart, well, you learned at MIT. There's people smarter than you, and there are people who are not as smart as you. That's just the given. Pretty? Well, look around. So basically, there's always going to be variation in everything. And yet we say there's a fundamental equality. Now, the reason why this is self-evident in our society is because even though it is post-Christian, it has Christian roots. See, and this is, again, growing up in a Buddhist country, you realize this is not self-evident. The same thing here. Intrinsic dignity is the ground for the claim that we are worth more than any other animal or plant. Again, if you go to Thailand, this is not clear. This is not self-evident because of the account of reincarnation. And you need something to ground these claims. Because you and I, in the West, we assume we're worth more than cows. And yet if you go to India, I have friends in India, because of religious and philosophical, they will say that cows are actually more valuable than human beings, which is why they are allowed in certain areas of India to roam free and can sit in the middle of the road and block traffic, and no one will think twice about just waiting until the cow gets up and moves away, because it is much more valuable than you and me. And so an account of intrinsic dignity allows us to make these claims. If you deny intrinsic dignity, then it's more difficult to do that. So for faith-based bioethics, dignity is the ground for autonomy. You get it? We say that choosing and knowing are really valuable, and we should respect those because you in fact are you have this dignity that elevates you above everything else and makes us all equal. As such, you see, dignity concerns can limit and constrain autonomy. And this is where my colleagues and I who debate anything when it comes to secular and Catholic, they will say autonomy cannot be limited, while for Catholic and Christian bioethics, it certainly can. Dignity can limit autonomy. And so certain choices are simply ruled out because they do not inherently respect the dignity of the human person. So this is kind of like a lay of the land. So how then do we look at CRISPR? The dignity concerns with regards to CRISPR can be listed pretty much under these four categories. I'm just going to go through them. So they notice they're always about persons because they're always about dignity in some form. So safety of persons, the concern here is off-target mutations. You're trying to change this gene, but you end up changing that gene. That person gets cancer. It's unsafe. And I know that there are numerous labs here in the Boston-Cambridge area that are working mightily to try to develop an editing machine that will allow us to target genes with incredible specificity. There's also the concern about chimeric tissue. So chimera is a mixed. And so the idea is that if you want to target a particular gene, will you be able to target all the cells that make up a tissue, or are you going to have a mixture of edited versus non-edited, and how is this going to impact the health of the person? There's also the concern about the commodification of persons. So this is to make a person a commodity, to make the person an object. And so here, and I have no time to go into the substantial Catholic discussion regarding this particular area of ethics. This is something the Catholic tradition will share, for example, with Kant. Persons treated as means to fulfill the desires of others. You as a person, because of your intrinsic dignity, cannot be treated merely as a means. You have to be treated as an end. And there are specifications as to how that will happen. There's the concern in the Catholic tradition that artificial reproductive technologies and IVF, and I have no time at this point to really expand on this, on how the Catholic tradition has made a claim that part of the difficulty with artificial reproductive technologies, some of the in vitro fertilization techniques, it actually commodifies, it makes the person an object who is manufactured. And then here the concern is that persons are made in the image of another. And here, this is a very interesting thing. We see this already, you know. Your parents want you to be like them. And you will push back against that. The idea is that you as a person know that you have a unique destiny and you're going to fight back against parents imposing their particular vision of your life and your happiness on you. And yet, is that not what would happen if we allowed parents to genetically modify their children and so that those children are made in their image, and not necessarily in their physical image, but in light of their desires and hopes for a child rather than that particular individual? So, you know, you want your kid to be an NBA player. So you genetically engineer the kid. So the kid is 6'8". And the kid says, look, I want to be a pianist. And you're like, wait, I made you so you would be an NBA player. Everything about you has been designed for that. How can you be a pianist? You see how these kinds of concerns would be raised. On the larger scale, the Catholic tradition is concerned about the marginalization of persons. So the idea here is just driving through Boston, you already see social stratification. You already see social inequality. And the concern here is that CRISPR would be used to exacerbate that difference. The rich would be able to afford the technology to engineer their kids, to give their kids advantage that would make their kids rich, and you would have the poor not being able to access that. And so you would actually have serious intra-societal problems. I mean, we have problems now with healthcare. It's basic healthcare. We can't seem to agree about what we do to provide basic healthcare. So now we have that. We also have the eugenic temptations of society. People, you know, different generations will say we want to make the future better. And every society has an account of what is pretty and what is handsome. And we see that now. We talk about body shaming. We talk about all of these social expectations. And the danger is that these social expectations will now be translated into a eugenic attempt to basically eradicate what is perceived to be ugly or non-advantageous today. But as we know, these sort of things change. And then finally, there is the just access for all persons, because there's always going to have to be a preferential option for the poor and the vulnerable, especially in the Catholic tradition. And as I already pointed out, we're already struggling with healthcare. So, in conclusion, just to give you a sense of what I'm thinking when I go off and talk to my colleagues, both secular and Catholic, about how the Catholic tradition would imagine the guidelines. So, in principle, what I mean by that is it depends on the particular technique, it depends on the safety of the technique, it depends on the particular disease, but in principle, somatic cell modifications, changing the body of a patient, for therapeutic reasons, including therapeutic enhancements, could be morally justified. In principle, germline modifications for therapeutic reasons, including therapeutic enhancements, could be morally justified. If you can heal this person, why not heal this person's children? If this person's children could also benefit from that disease, from that medical intervention. Why do we have to wait until that child is born with the disease in order to then correct it? Now, this is a very controversial statement today. Even the National Academy of Sciences and the national, the medical version of that, I'm a scientist, so the National Academy of Medicine, actually. So there's a current moratorium, I suggest a moratorium on germline modification, because we have to talk about efficacy, we need to talk about safety. But the question is, in principle, could be justified? I would argue that it could, because if we're going to treat a patient, we should be able to treat the patient before rather than after he gets the disease. Germline modifications for non-therapeutic enhancements could never be justified from the Catholic moral tradition, because the idea here is now, for all those other concerns, that you are actually limiting the future potential of a person, you're making that person into your image and likeness, you're actually limiting their options for the kind of vocation that they're searching for, all of these would be concerns. And so, this is my last slide. Faith-based secular approaches, if you want to compare the ethics, there are different counts of human dignity. Faith-based approaches posit both intrinsic and extrinsic, and secular accounts do not know how to deal with an intrinsic account of dignity in a post-Christian society. And then faith-based approaches, because of the claim that we have both intrinsic and extrinsic dignity, we make the claim that dignity can limit autonomy. If you do not have intrinsic dignity, then the account basically focuses on the individual and the individual choices. So, acknowledgement. So, this is my lab, and it's a cool lab. One of them is here right now, and I bring it up because, you know, I run an undergraduate research laboratory, and when I graduated with my PhD from MIT, I did not know what that meant. I had 2 Europes while I was here. But the Europe was at the bottom of the totem pole. My PI never talked to the Europe. And I dealt with the Europe 24/7. I even wrote the letters for the Europe, and my PI just signed the letters for the Europe. And I went to Providence College and discovered that you can run a laboratory just with undergrads. I have the option of taking postdocs. I've had 2 postdocs. I've discovered I prefer undergrads to postdocs for many reasons. and one of the things that, and I bring it up here because there are some of you here who might never have considered a vocation of being a professor at a primarily undergraduate institution, and that's why I'm here, just to say that sort of thing is possible and that sort of thing is very cool. One of my own undergraduate students came and did his PhD in course 7 here, and it was really cool because my PI was on his defense, was when I was his committee, and so I attended his defense, and my PI came up to me and goes, boy, time goes by quickly. Now, one of your students is defending. I'm like, yeah. So it's a really cool thing. It's a great privilege of my life to teach you about this map. This is our grant, but I want to focus here on the grant. We had a grant from the BioLogos Foundation. The BioLogos Foundation was founded by Francis Collins, who is the director of the NIH. He's an evangelical Christian. And when he was appointed director of the NIH by President Barack Obama, several hundred scientists, including some from MIT, wrote a letter in protest because they did not think that a Christian could be a good scientist. And so he founded the BioLogos Foundation. It's a foundation that is involved in the science-religion dialogue, and we got a grant from them in order to do this. So this is a website called Thomistic Evolution, and Thomistic Evolution is an attempt to use the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. I thought, given this is the Thomistic Institute lecture, it would be appropriate for me to end with Thomas Aquinas, that to bring together a coherent account based on metaphysics for how someone could look at evolution and see how God works through that. Thank you so very much for your attention. That's God.
Thank you, Father Nick, for a great talk. I just wanted to push back a little bit on your terminology between faith-based and secular. In part because the secular is also faith-based. It's like you said, it comes from a Christian tradition. But this idea that the human will comes before nature is where it comes from. And then that's actually, maybe it's more Franciscan or something. I don't know.
Well, I think you and I could acknowledge that the secular tradition has a lot... is part of a 2,000-year-old reflection that is Christian, but I doubt many of my secular colleagues would actually admit to any religious or faith-based claim to their position, right? Now, you can see this if you go to a non-Christian culture, if you go to Thailand, you go to Japan, or go to China, which I go to, one of the things is they don't understand why consent plays such a big role. Now, the reason why consent plays such a big role is precisely because the Christian claim is that consent, intellect and will makes you in the image and likeness of God, which is why it's cool. Now, it's also cool because it allows you to do great experiments, right? But it's really striking when you go to different traditions, you see that what you take as self-evident is not necessarily self-evident in other traditions. But you're correct. I mean, the secular bioethics of the West is still post-Christian. It's not completely divorced of its Christian roots.
And I think someone like Michael Sandel might agree with the faith-based approach, even though he takes a secular line, too. So.
And I think what he would say is he would be more Kantian, he would say it's philosophical.
Yeah.
But one of the things I wanted to highlight is that even Kant, whether or not he knew it, was working on Christian first principles.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe this is a vague question, but you made a split between what you can and can't do with manipulating the genome between therapeutic and non-therapeutic. What popped into my head was, could there be like a teleological argument there? Like, what is the genome supposed to be? And then that allows you to decide what you can edit and not. So if something just changes the eye color, you know, whatever, maybe that's a different category than something that causes a defect. And is that the same as therapeutic versus non-therapeutic, or is that a different argument?
So one of the things I'm thinking about right now is, so I made that distinction, therapeutic and non-therapeutic, and a lot of people are asking, what exactly is that distinction, right? So a lot of people will say, for example, if I give you growth hormone and you grow to 6'4", there's a lot of data that suggests that taller individuals succeed more in society. So you can see this. In terms of voting, for example, people will tend to vote for the taller person. If they're and they've done enough studies. They've shown that the taller person tends to come up on top. And so I have people say, well, isn't that therapeutic? And you're going, well, therapeutic. So my inclination, especially because I think I'm a biologist, is that therapeutic tends to focus on the physiological and not necessarily the social benefits associated with that. So we're talking here about immunization, we're talking here about preventing you from getting disease. Now, I worked in the Guerenti lab for my PhD, so the question now that I've been asked to think about is longevity research right? So my PI currently is the chief scientific officer of a company here that is selling, it's a company, its name is Elysium, and it's selling $60 pills that will extend your health span, I think is the way they call it. And the question is, what is the genetics of that? Is that therapeutic or is that an enhancement? Now, it's really, that to me is actually where I think my distinction will, what I have to really think about that. Because if you keep someone young over a longer period of time, physiologically, they're actually healthier. So the idea is that, you know, if we were able to keep you young for 80 years before you underwent degeneration or aging at the end, is that enhancement or is that therapy? That's a real distinction that I'm still thinking about. But in terms of like the height thing, I think people are like, yeah, the height thing, being a tall, healthy human being versus a short human being, healthy human being, you're still a healthy human being. There may be social advantages of being tall, and that's where the social enhancement dimension comes in. In terms of teleology, it's very striking to talk about the teleology of the genome, because the teleology of the human genome is there primarily to make a human being. It's not necessary for a particular human being to be X, Y, or Z. So if you say that as long as it fulfills the teleology, it makes a human being, then you'll be able to change the person, look right, whatever, because as long as the person's at the end. So I'd have to think about that. I'm going to switch your questions. It's more about what is the teleology of therapy? That's really where we have to think about. What is therapy supposed to do in terms of an end? Yes.
Your argument against the addition of somatic cells.
Against somatic cells.
Yeah. The addition of somatic cells. It was based on human dignity.
I suggested at the very end that modification of somatic cells for therapeutic reasons would be fine.
Let's talk about for enhancement.
For enhancement.
So it was based on human dignity, which was defined from conception to...
So remember, dignity is as long as you're human. So the idea is that when did you become human? The idea is you became human at conception, so it would begin there. And it would end, you know, when do you stop being human? The idea is at your death. That's why the definition is that way.
Yes, so if we did cells, it's before conception, it's before there is even a human being. So I wondered how one could base an argument on dignity when it's cells.
So in that case, it would be germline modification. So the idea is that you are changing the DNA of a future generation, right? Because the person is not there yet. And so, as I suggested, germline modification could be justified for therapeutic reasons, because if you know this individual is going to be born with muscular dystrophy, and you know that it's a mutation in this gene, could you alter this person's, his parents' sperm or his parents' eggs so that when he is conceived, he actually doesn't have the disease? I think you can justify that. The question is whether or not you can justify the enhancement of that person. I've suggested that there would be more problems with that, not necessarily because of the technique, but because of the personal ramifications and social ramifications of us allowing parents to determine the ideal or better traits of their children, which is usually in their image and likeness, that which is time-bound and culturally bound. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
You were saying that the main argument that you have with secular people is about dignity versus consent. But I was wondering, because when just talking with people, one point where we actually have a real problem is more about how do we define a human being, and when do we start being a human being, actually. So is that also present with you?
It's actually, if you realize it, it's the same debate. Because think of it this way. If intrinsic dignity begins when you are human, then that debate will translate to when you become human. You see, so So if the claim is that intrinsic dignity is priceless worth as long as you're a human, then not surprisingly, the debate is going to be when we become human. Because so when people argue about when human beings begin, what they're actually saying is, when is intrinsic dignity a characteristic of this in, of this thing?
So what is usually the Catholic point of view and secular point of view about when?
Well, this is disputed, because in mice, for example, we have no doubt the new organism begins in conception. No doubt. And I'm a biologist, right? So you have conception, there is the new organism, and we talk about the zygotic this, the zygotic that. But because of the moral implications, we have a distinction. So now I have conversations with many secular people, and I have people say, I do not want it to be at conception. Because if it's at conception, I can't do certain things. So given that, let's talk about. So we'll talk about human being. They'll make a distinction between human being and human person. And they will say a human being comes to be at conception, but not a human person. And what they usually mean by that is they mean the capacity for intellect and will. Right?